This is Irene Borger with Backstage LA. Our guest for today is Maurice Sendak, author and illustrator of more than 80 books, including the beloved In the Night Kitchen and Where the Wild Things Are. Nutcracker Sendak's vision of the 19th century E.T.A. Hoffman tale has just been published in paperback by Crown Books. In addition to his handheld artistry, Sendak has designed numerous theatrical productions, including the Mozart's Magic Flute, Janáček's The Cunning Little Vixen, and Prokofiev's The Love for Three Oranges, as well as Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker, performed annually by the Pacific Northwest Ballet. In 1990, the 20th anniversary of the publication of In the Night Kitchen, he and colleague Arthur Yorings formed The Night Kitchen, a national theater company devoted to the development of performing arts productions for children, plays, musicals, ballet, and operas, well beyond that divide known as children's theater. John Gross of the New York Times once wrote about him, quote, "If one hesitates to call Sendak the most foremost illustrator in contemporary America or the most accomplished draftsman, it's only because those terms set too narrow a limit on the nature of his achievement. He is an artist, nothing less, an artist with a powerful vision." I also like how Sendak assessed himself recently. He said, "I write about little boys naked in milk." Welcome, Maurice Sendak.
Thank you. Thank you. I've gotten in trouble because of that. Yeah.
Could you talk about that?
Well, just briefly, because it's so reductive in terms of what In the Night Kitchen is about. So to have spent 10 years talking about his private parts is hardly what was intended when I created that work. But because it was apparently the first frontal nudity in American children's books, it was censored. It still is, actually. It's kept out of certain libraries, unless the teacher or principal, whoever, takes a magic marker and covers the unsightly portion of his anatomy.
Mm. You always seem to go for the shadow or the darkness or the liminal. You seem not, even in this culture of censorship, not to have such a self-censor.
No, and well, but there is somebody to censor me afterwards. But of course you can't. I mean, if the work is going to be honest, and if I didn't choose to write for children. The work is categorized that way. It's simply, where do you put my books? You know, it's, as we said, little boys swimming in milk. They don't go next to Saul Bellow or Norman Mailer. But they, since they come out of the aesthetic and the complicated mind of a middle-aged man, and I don't intend to write things for children specifically, so there's another form that someday will be, I hope, appreciated as another kind of book to read. But yes, the kids read it, you know, and finally over the years I've become happier about the kids reading it simply because they're a much more ferocious and virile and honest audience than any other kind of audience you can imagine. And more than anything else, they need the support systems from older people and the honesty of older people.
I was wondering about that phrase, "and they live happily ever after," and how that is not your credo.
No, it isn't. It's a lovely credo. It's lovely to end the stories that way and have a happy fantasy of their future. But since that isn't the way, there are other ways of ending it that are not dismal, but that aren't as, well, fatuous as that.
Was that, I know you know so much about the history of children's books, but was that invented at some point?
It probably was, it's probably a bad translation from the German or the French or something like that. I can't believe the Europeans would be so simple-minded and give it such an easy ending. But it's what came down to us probably from maybe the 17th or the 18th century. Hmm. Yeah.
I remember reading a book called Le Conte Populaire Français, and in the introduction, it's a list of story types. It's quite marvelous. The introduction, it's by the published in France, and they were criticizing the Germans for the particularly violent stories. Isn't it unusual with American tales not being quite so violent in this violent culture?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's hypocrisy, you might say. And so what are we protecting the children from? I mean, you can't show them a little boy's penis in a book, but you let them watch television where every unsightly thing is visualized and bloated corpses and all the rest. So what is this? I mean, what does it finally mean? Somebody censored a drawing recently that I did for a newspaper, and I was just totally outraged that they even asked me to fix it so that it was slightly erotic, only slightly. And when I pointed out to them that they had their Calvin Klein inserts where you have everybody on top of everybody and you don't know who's doing what to what, and that's okay. I mean, kids see that. Everybody sees that. That's okay. That's advertising. But a drawing carefully wrought out of an old man's head, you're going to censor? That's the kind of hypocrisy we're dealing with. It's very troublesome because it's the kids who get the tail end of it, the bad end of it.
When I was driving over here, I was thinking, the Emperor's New Clothes popped into my head, and in some ways I felt that you were the child in the parade.
A little bit. The old child in the parade. You get in trouble for doing it, I suppose, but I don't care about that. I'm like, speaking professionally, say, as an author, I'm kind of like the tick on the dog's back. They're not going to get rid of me now, you know. When the dog dies, I croak. Mm. But in fact, it's given me terrific privilege to do what I want to do. Not everybody likes it. Get a lot of angry hate mail. Sinister messages on my phone machine, which I could live without. But nevertheless, the work progresses. And all through the years I've done it, like punching little holes into what was conventionally acceptable. I don't want to sound like a pioneer. I didn't intend to do anything like that. Simply doing books correctly, or doing books in the way that I thought were honest to myself. And I've been trained by wonderful people as a young man to do that kind of book. I mean, it started in the 50s, you did terrific books. It was Margaret Wise Brown, who's hardly mentioned anymore. Thank God a biography is coming out of her, who was the mother of us all. This intense, passionate little book she did about real children. That attitude and that thinking has gone, largely.
You know, I was surprised that you talked about how important it was to you to teach at this stage in your career and life.
Yeah.
Not because of the teaching, but because it seemed like you've been, as you say, giving something back throughout your entire life, through the books.
Yeah, that's true, but at the same time, the way the structure is now, socially, it is so hard for young artists to make the way I made my way. I just took it for granted that everybody was on my side. Everybody wanted me to be straight and honest. Everybody wanted me to do the best I could. Nobody was urging me to make a whole bunch of money. It's just the reverse now. It's suggested subliminally that not to be honest on certain levels will get your books sold better, so that in fact you'll make bigger books and make an 8-book contract or something. It's devastatingly lethal to young artists to put that in their heads. So you have kids who, having lived through Reagan and Bush, will in fact just go zooming up and think this is okay. But then you have those few kids who are throwbacks, the kind of kids I was, who absolutely don't know what to do and can't earn a living and can't sell a book or can't sell a play or can't sell a movie. And those are the ones that you want to help. You want to support them and say, you're right. You just got to hang out and suffer a little bit longer. But that's what you got to be as an artist. And that's, you must. And if you're not that, then get the hell out. Then you're just like the other fakers. Mm. That's why you have to come out. And that's why you have to be a mentor and help.
There are obviously so many differences, I imagine, between designing for books and the stage. But one of the things I was thinking about is that the experience of reading is so different than going to the theater, going from the very private, very intimate, especially the Nutshell Library, to more of a collective experience. And I wonder, in some ways, is there any kind of subliminal, almost political thrust to your movement into theater?
Into children's theater,
yeah.
Or into opera, or
into public performance versus books?
Well, I don't know that. I don't know that I can answer that. It's just a different format. It's just a different place. The need for me is more important rather than them, in a sense, because it does what I mentioned somewhat before. It puts me into social context with other people, where I can be useful to other people. I can't do that in books. Books is a solitary work. You can spend 3 years all by yourself in Connecticut doing a book, and then it comes out. You get an idiot review, and boom, it's over. Okay, great. I've done the book, and it's wonderful, but I now need more than that. Now, when I stopped doing books and started designing operas, it was because I needed other artists to work with. I needed collaboration with directors and backstage people, and it was wonderful for 10 years. It still is wonderful, but now I need another kind of social mix. I need young people.
So will you talk about what you're doing with the Night Kitchen Theatre Company?
Well, the Night Kitchen Theatre Company is a not-for-profit children's theatre, and it's a national theatre. We don't have our own theatre, so we will piggyback all over the country. We have productions now forming in St. Louis, in Houston, Grand Opera, in Toronto Opera, and I hope Pacific Northwest Ballet again will want to work with us, Kennedy Center. So we're all over the country. And if we're lucky and the show's a successful day, we'll travel. And that's where our money will come from so that we can do more productions. But to show right from the beginning that by children's theater, we don't mean, you know, Rumpelstiltskin. We mean the play, we mean the opera, we mean the musical, we mean the ballet, we mean the book, we mean the movie, we mean the radio, every medium or form which a child will come in contact with, to elevate it. It sounds very grandiose, but that is my ambition, on a small scale, to do the very best I can to infuse into that something which has been lost by and large. There are marvelous children's theaters all over the country. I'm not saying we're coming like Rambo. That's a strange image, but I said it.
You're not coming like Rambo.
Not coming like Rambo. So that, in fact, we will be doing our own kind of theater, and I will be producing on stage the complicated theatrical pieces that are similar to the things I did in the books. Nobody can categorize my books and say those are kiddie books. I dare them to do that. Because I know I don't know how to write a children's book. I don't have a child in my life. It's pretentious to talk about children's books as though you knew what you were doing or you're doing it for kids. No. It just simply worked out that way. The kids were crusaders. When The Wild Things came out and it was denounced, it was the kids who went to the library. It was a crusade. They took the book out. They knew what was there. The hell with what the grown-ups were saying. That was marvelous for me. Such encouragement. I had an audience.
And there was that letter you got that asked, could I go where the wild things are?
Yeah. How much does it cost to get where the wild things are? I want to take my sister there next summer. Yeah. I wish I could have given him proper information. Actually, it's a free trip. so that, in fact, that's what, I hope that's answering your question.
Well, are you the executive producer?
I'm the artistic director.
And what does that really mean?
Artistic director is the man who will decide what the productions are, what's worthy of producing. What will the shows be? Who will we be working with? What is the level or the standard, the aesthetic standard? Who's going to come in and light the show? Who's going to direct the show? There's going to be a quality of standard here that's going to be very, very important. I'm a huge pain to everybody in publishing simply because I make such high demands on those books, and I have a right to. After I spent 3 to 5 years on it, they got to produce it correctly, and they will. If you're working with the right people, that's what they want too. So I'm on the press and I'm picking the paper, and I don't probably stand on the street and sell the book. But in fact, such will be the same here. And it's going to be much more difficult. I'm not fooling myself. Having worked in theater for over 10 years now, the chain of people, there are weak links all the way down the line. A book is much more controlled.
And so why do you feel it's really necessary now?
Because I'm 63 years old, and when am I going to do it? I've got to get out there and do it before I croak. Put it very bluntly.
Well, why is it necessary for the culture? Why do you perceive
Because
that?
I think things are dismal in all directions. I think children are abused horrendously. I think there is nothing for them at all on television, in the movies, and children's books are now becoming as money-earning stuff. In other words, we used to be a separate cottage industry. We're now like the big guys, okay? And we're just as screwed up as the big guys. So that there are too many bad books coming out all over the place. So in fact, you have to fight now. Something has gone amiss. And I recognize and remember a time where there were principles, where there were ethics. And I feel they're getting lost. And I'm not alone in feeling that. I can't stay up in the country and do any more books. I can't. I'm guilty. I can't do operas. I'm guilty. I have to be out there teaching, doing, showing. I may fall, it may be all wrong, it may not happen, but that's besides the point. My impulse is now in my life, while I still have the physical strength and my brain is still partially functioning, to get out and help and do something.
Did you ever have theatrical experiences as a child that stay with you?
Only grotesque ones, like going to Radio City Music Hall and seeing the Rockettes. I loved it. First you saw Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and then you saw these girls kicking up. Okay, it was great. But I don't have memories of them. But then again, I wouldn't have. My parents were poor. There was no such thing. The only theater I saw was never for children, because my mother and father went into New York on the East Side to see the Yiddish theater. And I loved it. We all spoke Yiddish, and I sat there, and the weeping and screaming that went on in the audience was wonderful, crying. the woman on stage stands up there, and her daughter-in-law, whom we know is a terrible person, says, I will become better. I will come live with us. Here, her mother-in-law lives in a shanty town, a wreck. I have abused you, but your son, grandson will be bar mitzvah. I will be a good, I'll be a contrite daughter-in-law. And the woman looks at the audience like, should she trust her? My father leaves her. Don't trust her. She's a bitch. And everybody in the audience is screaming. I was in seventh heaven. You know, it was what people do now, audience and play, everything going all together. That was my experience in the theater. I never knew. I didn't read children's books. There weren't any. It was Mickey Mouse comics, and it was the Big Little books, and it was Flash Gordon. And you didn't go to anything that had to do with children. And in some curious way, it was not bad at all.
Let's talk about The Nutcracker. My experience of your book, because I haven't seen the production, is that it really gets to the heart, particularly of Drosselmeyer, which I feel has been, when I went to the, you know, when I've been to the Balanchine and the Joffrey mm-hmm. versions, I always felt like there was something very erotic and magical about him.
There is. But then people immediately conclude that he's a child abuser. Because if it's erotic, what's he doing there? Well, it doesn't mean that at all. It just means that he just ain't all there as a grown-up and is much happier with children than he is with grown-ups, as was Lewis Carroll, as was Hans Christian Andersen, as were any number of people who wrote very strange and wonderful works of art. So we didn't try to make Drosselmeyer scandalous. He's not trying to get his hands on Clara. He simply prefers to be with her and her bunch of people. And we wanted to make that as poignant and as sad and as interesting as possible because he's an artist. And the joy he gets from making her happy, I thought of Lewis Carroll a good deal during that production and his enormous need to make Alice Hargrove happy. And he did with a great work of art. So that's Drosselmeyer, the guy who hangs out with the kids. And I wanted to make that very emphatic. He's usually a very adroit and cool manipulator. No, he's not. He's a klutz. He's a desperate klutz who just doesn't know where to be socially. That's all. I know lots of people like that.
Could you describe the difference between working on the production for the ballet and then working on the book?
Sure. The first good luck for the ballet was Kent Stoll and his wife Francia of the Pacific Northwest Ballet, and that they were willing to go back to E.T.A. Hoffman. They were willing to take this ballet, which I really profoundly not much like. So then they were trying to persuade me to design it, and I said, well, can we do something a little different? Well, you have so much yardage of Tchaikovsky, and you know, you can't betray Tchaikovsky because that music is glorious. It's glorious. So we went back to the Hoffman, we re-dramatized it, we made a scenario, and I presented that to them, and they liked it, and I got as much of Hoffman up on the stage as I possibly could. We even added more music, which was more Tchaikovsky from the opera Pique Dame, which was a pastiche of Mozart in the same key as Nutcracker, so of course it was meant to be. And E.T.A. Hoffman, the A stands for Amadeus, and there's Tchaikovsky loving Mozart, and there's me freaking out over Mozart. It seemed right. But even with that little extra music, there was so much of the fairy tale which could not be staged. It's just too long a fairy tale. So that when Crown came and said, would you like to illustrate the book, I freaked out because there are all those episodes I can now illustrate in this, you're having your cake and eating it. Plus, they agreed with me, we go get a fresh translation. We don't use these old Victorian translations. There's Ralph Mannheim, still living and working in France. And Ralph did the translation. It's great. So I got to do The Nutcracker on stage and in the book. And it was a triumph. And it was printed beautifully, manufactured beautifully. Just one of the great times of my life.
I'm Irene Borger, and our guest today is Maurice Sendak. Mr. Sendak, you were talking about the difference between illustrating and decorating books.
Right.
And I started to think about the relationship between Merce Cunningham and John Cage and how, for them, music and dance were parallel but very separate tracks. Since you are so involved in music and in the quality of time, how does that come into your work?
It's a conceit of the imagination because it literally can't come into the work. But since I would have preferred to have been a musician than a graphic artist, or a composer like Schubert writing songs or Hugo Wolf writing songs, then I imagine while I am drawing that I am setting something to music. Okay? So I will have the music, I will have the machine going. It might be my favorite thing, like the Schubert posthumous piano sonatas. And then I will draw to them. now I'm suddenly Franz Schubert, who was setting music to words, and I'm turning it around. It's a conceit which is a marvelous exercise for the imagination. I insist that music become part of every book I do and that it be syncopated to the music, but I'm making it up. I'm making it up because there's such a desperate wish that I could be in music, that I could be doing something musical. I'm doing a life of Mozart now by listening to endless amounts of music of Mozart and doing his biography, doodles, sketches of his life, all invention, sometimes based on the facts of his life, often just based on my fantasy of him. And I'm having the most wonderful time doing it because I'm writing music. That's as close as I'll ever get to writing music.
But you were talking about certain texts really not should not be illustrated because they're already so descriptive. When you were working on The Nutcracker, did you feel that way, or did you actually see things?
Oh, yeah. If I don't see pictures within 3 minutes of reading a text, that book ain't going to get no pictures.
And if you don't, do you see pictures in listening to the score same way?
Oh, yeah. Early when I was very young, I used to fill endless sketchbooks with Mahler, listening to Mahler symphonies, and just drawing. It actually ignites something in the electrical current somewhere in the brain, and the picture making starts from listening to music. So there is something that was meant to be music, but in the wiring, something got screwed up. But it's all right. It's worked out in another way. Yeah, it's worked out in a way that's very gratifying.
When you talked about the Nutcracker and Tchaikovsky, you talked about that kind of wild animal elements that got bowdlerized, I guess, in the later versions.
Yeah, it's not in Tchaikovsky. It's not in the music.
It's just in Hoffman,
you mean? It's in the version of Hoffman that gets on stage.
Uh-huh.
It's in Petipa, or whoever choreographed the original ballet in Russia. But Tchaikovsky, whose instinct was unerring, has all the bite and crackly rat noises in that music, which are marvelous, and it's erotic, incredibly erotic. He got away with murder, but he knew what he was doing. He knew he was unerringly correct. I think it's one of the best ballet scores, even though I'm sick to death of it. It nevertheless is with Sleeping Beauty. Those are my two favorite ballet scores.
Will you go on to do Sleeping Beauty?
Somebody out there asks me. Sure, I guess it's a very difficult ballet to solve, but musically it's gorgeous.
One last very quick question. How can we bring The Night Kitchen to Los Angeles?
Ask me.
Maurice Sendak, thank you very much. Backstage LA, this is Irene Borger.